It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered my home.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and threaten me.
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
And maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
I woke up this morning and I checked the results of New Japan's Dominion show, which wrapped up a few hours ago. So yes, there are some Dominion spoilers here if you want to avoid. You might want to skip ahead. The most predictable of all the outcomes is that Will Ospreay is the number one contender for the IWGP United States Championship. He beat Lance Archer, and they are indeed doing the rematch at Forbidden Door. On June 25th, it will be a rematch of maybe the match of the year so far. Can two men have two match of the year candidates in the same year? Why, yes. Yes, they can. It will be Kenny Omega defending against Will Ospreay in Toronto. And that match alone makes that pay-per-view worth whatever price they're going to be charging for it. But then I saw the video of Bryan Danielson hiking through the Red Rocks in Las Vegas. See, now we know what he made Wheeler Yuta go hiking for. You remember the media scrum last Sunday at Double or Nothing? He said that he had forced Yuta to go hiking with him, and now we know who was filming this video. But it was a video that Jon Moxley introduced after he, Claudio, and Yuta lost this morning to Okada, Tanahashi, and Ishii. Of Danielson, where he said that for the last 10 years, he has heard about the great Okada. Not the great Okan, but the great Okada and how great Okada is and how he was considered the best wrestler of this generation. He said Okada is good, but he is the litmus test of great. He said Okada may be the rainmaker, but when he steps into the ring with him, Okada is going to be in the desert and there won't be any rain. If you could see the smile on my face after watching this. And after the video aired, Okada accepted the challenge and he teased that it would happen at Forbidden Door. Amazing. This is the match I've wanted to see since Bryan left WWE. Of all the opponents, you could talk about Omega, you could talk about anybody you want to. This is the match that I've wanted to see the most with him since he left WWE. This is, to me, the current holy grail of wrestling matches that we have not seen. The American Dragon against the Rainmaker. In Toronto, in front of that Canadian crowd. Tony Khan does not have to book another match for that show. Danielson against Okada and Omega against Ospreay, that already makes it the show of the year, without even announcing anything else. Just take my money now. Holy shit. Bryan and Omega, they both missed last year's Forbidden Door. Kenny was still out, healing up from all the surgeries. Danielson, he was supposed to wrestle Zack Sabre Jr., he got concussed, and he had to be pulled from the match. That's when Claudio was his substitute. Claudio made his debut. So now, not only do we have this, we have Bryan also teasing a match with Nigel McGuinness for Wembley Stadium in August. Now, I don't know if Nigel is actually going to come out of retirement or not, but if we get Bryan against Okada, and then Bryan against Nigel in London, that's one hell of a summer right there. Add in Tanahashi against MJF, which I think is a possibility for Forbidden Door, or maybe even Tanahashi against CM Punk, which was going to be the match last year before Punk got hurt. You add that to the card, there's your triple main event right there. It's enough to soften the blow a little bit of another G1 climax without Danielson. They announced the field of 32 this morning. The G1 kicks off July 15th, ends on August 13th. Okada, Sanada, Tanahashi, Naito, Ospreay, Shingo, they're all in there. But Ospreay was my pick to win it at the beginning of the year. I'm going to stick to that. The two big surprise names announced were Kaito Kiyomiya from Pro Wrestling Noah, who Okada beat earlier this year, and Eddie Kingston is in the G1, the man who banished Jay White from New Japan at the Battle in the Valley a few months ago. So it has already been a very eventful morning. This is episode 811 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, June 4th, 2023. CM Punk is officially back in AEW. We have the date and the location. I'm going to talk about that. Roman Reigns has a new championship belt, and it is not good. Just how close New Japan really came to shutting down for good during the pandemic, I'm going to talk about that. I also get to play Maury Povich today and announce that you are not the father. I will tell you what that is in reference to. And Dark Side of the Ring is back. I've got a full review for you on Chris and Tammy. All that and more on today's episode. Thank you for supporting. Drop a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify if you would. I want to give a shout out to everybody who has supported via PayPal this week, which of course you can do on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link at the top of the link tree. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. I want to say thank you first to PB. You know who you are. Thank you very much. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al Safar, Big B Brian Becerra, Killshot Keith Hart, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, Daredevil Doug Lippert, Road Warrior Roderick Welch, Iowan Corn Farmer Jesse Lampier, The Fighting Artist AJ Lupo, Russell Jackson, thank you Russell, and Brandon the Original New Yorker Wilson, who is celebrating his 20th birthday today. Happy birthday, Brandon. He just attended the WWE event in White Plains last night. I don't know if that was your birthday gift, but I hope you had fun. I did not have a chance to review Raw on Monday because I was sick, but I did watch the show. I laid down and I put on the show that night. I was out within 10 minutes. I have to thank WWE. Best sleep that I have gotten in ages, like 10 hours worth. It was amazing. But I went back and I watched what I missed the next morning. AJ Styles showed up. The same AJ Styles who was drafted to SmackDown a few weeks ago. The same AJ Styles who would have been on Raw had he beaten Seth Rollins at Night of Champions to win the World Heavyweight title, which he did not. But he showed up on Raw anyway, in what PW Insider confirmed was a last-second creative change made by Vince McMahon, who has been calling in changes remotely to the shows. It was a Vince call to get AJ on the show. Styles had already flown straight home from Saudi Arabia after getting back to the States last Sunday, but then got the call that he was needed, and he flew right back out to Raw. I would love to know why it was so important for him to be on this show that they would have him, they would fly him home just to summon him back out on the road. Because having watched this show, there was no reason for him to be there. Brand split be damned. All I could do is laugh. How could you not have seen this coming? How could you not have seen this coming from a mile away? Of course, it was a Vince McMahon call. I'm just amazed at how quickly they reminded us of what a farce this whole thing is. I figured they would at least give it a month before they started ignoring it. Styles even acknowledged in his promo, "I'm on SmackDown, I shouldn't even be here." But he said he couldn't resist coming to Raw to congratulate Seth. This was the very definition of, this could have been an email. He said the fans chanted, "You deserve it," at Seth, but he doesn't deserve anything. He earned it. And then they were interrupted by the Judgment Day, which led to a main event at the end of the show with Rollins and Styles as partners against Finn Balor and Damian Priest. After this, Adam Pearce was in the back on the phone with somebody who was never identified, presumably Vince McMahon or Triple H, looking for their approval to make the tag team match official, even though he admitted it flew in the face of the brand split with AJ being a SmackDown star. But they made the match anyway. And if I'm a SmackDown talent, I'm looking to maximize my television time, I'm going to fly myself out to Raw tomorrow too and get on the show. I mean, if AJ can do it, why can't everybody do it? The fact that they had Adam Pearce bring this up on television like, oh, they're acknowledging it, so that makes it okay. No, it doesn't. If anything, it makes it worse. Because they're acknowledging that talent from each brand are supposed to be specific to their own brand. They're reminding us of this, and then in the same breath, they're admitting that it doesn't matter. So why bother? I mean, if it's a soft split where talent belongs to a specific show, right? They call a specific show home base, let's say. But they're still allowed to openly go back and forth, then why not just call it that? Just don't insult the fans by pretending that this is something that it really isn't. If that's what they want the brand split to be, that's fine. It's the pretending that annoys me. But then that would render the draft completely unnecessary, and they wouldn't be able to pop a rating with it. It would be like It would be like the Panthers drafting Bryce Young in this year's NFL draft. But then in week three, he shows up to play for the Jets. Except the Jets have Aaron Rodgers now, so all their problems have been solved, until we find out that he pulled a hammy dancing to Taylor Swift. So we have new women's tag team champions, Ronda Rousey and Shayna Baszler. They won the Fatal 4-Way on Monday to crown new tag team champions. They beat out Raquel Rodriguez and Shotzi, Bayley and Io Sky, and Sonya Deville and Chelsea Green. So now what? Who challenges them now? There's no real competition. And Ronda Rousey herself said as much in an interview with the New York Post after their win on Monday. She said, "The lack of competition is really the problem. I mean, we want to be the most active champions out there. I want to be able to defend this title every week and even twice a week on both SmackDown and Raw. But with how dismally shallow the women's division is right now, there's not enough women around here to keep us busy for a month. And so that's the biggest challenge that we have, is to get this company to actually care and invest into this tag division. It was like the entire women's division just got stripped clean," she said, referring to the time between when she left in 2019 to become a mom and when she came back last year. She said, "Now we're the women that are left trying to piece together stories and a division, a tag division with around 10 women or even less on each roster. I mean, we're trying the best that we can to make chicken shit into chicken salad, and we made some amazing chicken salad on Monday night." I don't know about that last statement, but she's not wrong. They're swimming upstream. Have been for a very long time, and it has not gotten any better with Triple H as the chief content officer. This was my point all those weeks ago when I mentioned, you know, he has a real task in front of him coming out of WrestleMania and coming out of this draft as far as trying to put a greater emphasis mainly on mid-card stories. Not that the stories are, if there are any at the moment, around the actual women's championships are any good right now, but they're so laser-focused typically on just the Raw women's title and the SmackDown women's title. It's almost like to hell with everybody else. And you could argue, well, you know, some of the talent, maybe it's part of the problem is the talent they have and they're not that good or they're weak. Yeah, okay, fine. Maybe you can say that about some of the women. You can't say that about everybody on the roster. There has to be a clear focus here on stories and developing personalities, and they just have not been doing a very good job of that. Now they have two sets of tag team champions on the main roster, with Alba Fire and Isla Dawn walking around with the NXT Women's Tag Team titles. The best thing to do would be to merge them as soon as possible, but that's not going to end well for Alba and Isla if they do that. They have not even been established yet on television. They've had one match and a couple of videos. That's it. Actually, the best thing to do, if I'm being perfectly honest here, the best thing to do would be to burn the belts and spread their ashes behind the Alamo Dome over Bray Wyatt's gravesite where Roman Reigns buried Bray's body. If you listen to that person's voodoo theory from last week's mailbag. Just get rid of them. Just get rid of them altogether since they have no women's tag team division. Merge the Raw and SmackDown women's belt into one women's championship that floats and create a women's intercontinental title that also floats so that other women on the roster have something to fight for. That's part of the problem right now. It can be hard to develop stories in the mid-card if it feels like these women have nothing to fight for. A secondary women's title only works with one division, because you're not going to have an intercontinental and a U.S. title. The division is not big enough to support that. This idea only works with one singular division and a title that floats, not if you're going to cut the division in half between two shows. But that would give people like Zoe Stark and Mia Yim and Piper Niven and Chelsea Green and Indy Hartwell something to fight for with the bigger names occupying the title picture at the top of the card. The Rhea Ripley's of the world and Charlotte and Becky and Asuka and Io and Bianca. Right? That's for them. But what about the other women? That's where a women's intercontinental title would come into play. The issue is not that they don't have enough female talent, it's the way that they use or don't use the talent that they have. That's the problem. So after beating Becky Lynch at Night of Champions, Trish Stratus was on the show with her new protege, Zoe Stark. PW Insider says the plan is for Trish to be a weekly character on the show, so it's not a case where they only paired her up with Zoe so that, you know, Zoe could be her proxy on TV the weeks that she's not there. Who better to learn from, right? Stark said, than the OG herself. Thank you, Trish, is what she said. Becky Lynch came out, like Trish, wearing the same gear she had on for their match at Night of Champions. She had the Kill Bill outfit on. She wanted to restart the match, and after taking out Zoe, she took down Trish. Zoe came back, put Becky down with her Z360 finish, then picked her up, and Trish put her down with a punch. I said it last week, it is smart to pair Zoe up with Trish Stratus to try to give her some rub, whatever rub there is left for Trish to give her here in 2023. I haven't been a fan of these Trish promos since she went heel, but I can't fault them for pairing her up with Zoe. It gets Zoe involved in a visible storyline on the show every week instead of just having random matches. If you think about it, it makes little sense that Lita would not return to help Becky, considering Trish is the one who took Lita out in the first place. Why wouldn't she come back to back up Becky? Doesn't look like that's going to happen, which is kind of strange, because they could have set up for Becky and Lita against Trish and Zoe before doing the eventual Becky and Trish rematch at SummerSlam. But tomorrow night, we're getting two Money in the Bank qualifying matches for the women. We're getting Becky against Sonya Deville and Zoe against Natalya. Assuming Becky and Zoe advance, that would mean no tag team match. And I'm fine with that. If that's what they're going to do, I'm fine with that. If they want to have Becky and Zoe in the ladder match in London, that's fine. We got what I thought was a strong Cody Rhodes promo coming off his loss to Brock Lesnar. He didn't break any new ground, but his delivery, you know, he's still got the crowd with him every single week. He pointed out that he and Brock are each one win apiece now. He issued an open challenge to Lesnar. He hoped that Brock had cable or internet or a landline in Saskatchewan to relay the message. He's even said that he's going to post his schedule for the next month online with the hope that Brock sees it. And WWE has, in fact, posted Cody's schedule for the month of June online. He said Brock is beast enough to break his arm, but not man enough to make him tap out. If Brock does not accept his challenge, then the world would know that Brock Lesnar is afraid of Cody Rhodes. Of course there's going to be a third match. You don't end things when they're 1-1 against each other. Cody needs a decisive win to put a pin in this thing once and for all. I'm sure it's going to be a stipulation match of some kind. First, I was thinking, you know, last man standing. They already did Brock and Roman, though, last man standing at SummerSlam last year. It doesn't mean they can't do it again, but maybe not last man standing. They brought the fight pit stipulation in from NXT for the Rollins and Matt Riddle match at Extreme Rules last year. I think the fight pit could definitely work, especially with Brock being in there. Or, the other thing I was thinking, maybe Cody pulls a page out of the Dusty playbook, and we get a bull rope match. Bull rope matches are not my favorite stipulation, but I'm saying if you wanted to play the Dusty card, a bull rope match would make sense too. But it's probably SummerSlam. You know, if they do the match at Money in the Bank and Brock loses, who do they turn him around against that quickly for SummerSlam? Because you know they're going to want Brock at Ford Field. They're going to want Brock at SummerSlam this year. So if he goes to London, loses, you have 4 weeks to build up somebody completely different for him. It's just too quick of a turnaround. If anything, maybe Cody qualifies for Money in the Bank and Brock interferes and knocks him off the ladder, and then we get the SummerSlam match that way. But that's where I think the third match happens, and that's a long time yet to kill between now and then. Speaking of Money in the Bank, we had the first two qualifying matches for the men's Money in the Bank on this show on Monday. Ricochet beat The Miz in a match where Miz busted out a running Hurricanrana and a springboard high cross body. Miz was out there wrestling like someone said some shit about him on Twitter, and he was out there to prove a point. Ricochet and Money in the Bank will do some crazy things. You know, him being in that match makes sense. The reason Ricochet is back to wrestling singles is because Braun Strowman just underwent a level 1 fusion on Thursday on his C4 and C5 vertebrae in Birmingham, Alabama. Whenever you hear a wrestler is flying to Birmingham, I'm sure it's a lovely place this time of year, but that is never good news. He said on Instagram that it'll take a little bit of time for him to heal, but he will be back. And in the other Money in the Bank qualifier on Monday, and this one surprised me, Shinsuke Nakamura pinned Bronson Reed, handed Bronson Reed his first singles loss since coming back to the company. I'm not a big fan of that. I get that Triple H is trying to rehab Nakamura, but I would have liked to have seen Reed move on. Not the end of the world, just not the outcome that I was expecting. And in the main event, Seth Rollins and AJ Styles beat the Judgment Day when Rollins stomped and pinned Damian Priest. Fun match, but it just felt like filler for the Memorial Day holiday with AJ going right back to SmackDown. On Friday, Rollins tweeted, "My man Big E was the last defender of the crown in November of 2021. Let's change that. Open challenge for the World Heavyweight Championship is officially live for this Monday in Hartford." So I guess that means the last time that the WWE title was defended on Raw was November of 2021. So we have yet another open challenge gimmick in wrestling. I've lost track of how many open challenges we have right now. I know in AEW alone, we have like three of them going on. Damian Priest answered the challenge on Twitter, and the match has been made official. It will be Seth Rollins defending against Damian Priest tomorrow night. This will only be Seth's second defense of the new world championship. His first came at the house show the other night against The Miz. I'm so glad they had Rollins stomp his head in and then pin him in that tag team match on Monday. If they were going to have Priest challenge for the title the following week. That's great booking right there. Why did he have to take the loss in that match? Why ask why? I had three big takeaways from SmackDown on Friday night. LA Knight and Io Sky should be your Money in the Bank winners for 2023. WWE is lazy as shit when it comes to the designs of most of their championships. And the Bloodline story is still the most consistently entertaining part of any of these shows, Raw or SmackDown. And everybody involved deserves a medal for playing their part to perfection each and every week. So let's start there. Roman Reigns celebrated 1,000 days as champion with a special ceremony on Friday night, where Triple H presented him with a brand new belt, one that merges the WWE title and the Universal title into one. What that means for the lineage of the title, that was never explained. I'm talking about the physical belts have been merged now into one. The new belt is the same tired design that they have been using for a decade, only this time it has gold backing in the middle, behind the giant logo, and across the bottom, it says Undisputed Champion. Now think back to when WWE announced the creation of a new World Heavyweight title for Monday Night Raw. What I said at that time, that after Night of Champions, WWE can no longer refer to Roman Reigns as the Undisputed Champion, now that they have another world title. And yet, there it is, emblazoned on the belt itself, Undisputed. How can you have an undisputed champion when you have another world champion in the same company on the other show? That would make it the opposite of undisputed. It is now very much disputed. But what is undisputed is the fact that the consolation belt on Mondays is now the most attractive of all the belts in WWE. And they actually put some thought into the Raw belt. It has features, it pays homage to the world titles of the past. Obviously, it's a tribute to Big Gold, but it's got a crown, which was a nod to the belt that Bruno Sammartino held the first time in 1963. It has an eagle that references the Winged Eagle and the Big Eagle belts. It's got 60 diamonds on it to celebrate the company's 60-year history. They actually put some thought into it, and it has grown on me the more that I look at it. They didn't even make an effort to change the shape or anything. I mean, you would think Roman Reigns, this long run, I mean, there's no bigger star in the company than Roman Reigns. They could come up with something nice for him. Nope. After that, the Usos crashed the party. Jimmy again got up in his cousin's face. He stood up to him. He didn't back down. He tried to explain to Solo Sikoa that Roman is just using him. When he's done, he's going to kick him in the dirt. And Solo stood with his brothers. And Jimmy then pie-faced Roman again. Jey Uso got between them and tried to play peacemaker. Jimmy said, you know what? He's right. We are stronger together, not against each other. And Roman hugged him. And he was getting all emotional, and then he kind of looked up at the sky for a second, and then Roman still had the mic in his hand, even while he was hugging Jimmy, and he just said, no. And that's when Solo delivered a Samoan spike to Jimmy Uso. Roman and Solo, they left together. Jay stayed behind in the ring to tend to his brother. And Paul Heyman asked Roman Reigns, what about Jay? And Roman told him, Jay will do what Jay always does. He'll fall in line. He'll come home. And now the stage is set for an entire summer's worth of bloodline drama. It seems likely we're going to get a tag team match at Money in the Bank with Roman and Solo against the Usos. And I think Jey Uso challenging Roman Reigns for the championship at SummerSlam. You know, there are no other obvious opponents set up for Roman right now. Throwing AJ Styles in there after he just lost to Seth Rollins for the second place belt would feel hollow. I mean, that doesn't work. Bobby Lashley hasn't even been on television. It would feel forced. Roman he's fully engulfed right now in this bloodline story. If it isn't Jay, maybe we end up with a bloodline four-way for the title with all four men involved at SummerSlam, but I think Jey Uso is the play. It's what started this entire bloodline story was Roman Reigns against Jey Uso. And that's when Solo wakes up and finally comes to his senses. When Roman asks him to put the nail in his brother's coffin, that's when Roman finally loses Solo Sikoa. You know, the storytelling has been masterful with these men all the way through. I am beyond ready for Roman to drop that belt already, but it is clear that that's not going to happen, probably until next year's WrestleMania. Thankfully, their performances are so good, I'm invested in this storyline. That, you know, as long as we get segments on TV like the one we got on Friday, SmackDown is good. It's when the story finally ends that they may be in trouble, because there's nothing else on the show that comes anywhere close to this quality. But when the entire show is built around the bloodline every week, they sort of suck up all the oxygen. No other story really has a chance to break through the way this one has. My hope is that when the bloodline saga is over, they'll put as much effort into stories for the other talent on the show as they do for the Samoans. If you take away the bloodline stuff, that show on Friday was not good. Not good. LA Knight beat Montez Ford in a Money in the Bank qualifying match, the best match of the night. With the right man going over, the crowd booed everything Ford did, cheered everything LA Knight did, because the man is over. He is your Money in the Bank winner this year. I will accept no other answer. The question then is, how and when does he cash in? Right? Everyone might think, oh, LA Knight should win the briefcase. But then the question becomes, okay, now what? What do you do with the now? Could he go to Raw and cash in on Seth Rollins? Sure. And maybe he and Seth can trade the belt back and forth a couple of times. But that belt is going to Gunther at WrestleMania next year. But what if, and this is the only way I could see Jey Uso being the one to beat Roman Reigns and win the title. What if LA Knight wins the Money in the Bank briefcase? And then at SummerSlam, Jey Uso beats Roman Reigns. During the match, Roman loses Solo. Roman now is all alone, and Jey beats Roman. And because he's all alone, right? He's got no other family, no one left to help him out. He loses to Jay. To bring that story full circle, Jay gets his moment. And that's all it is. Because that moment is ruined by LA Knight, who cashes in and beats Jey Uso to become the WWE champion. Sound far-fetched, but it's the only way that I see Jey Uso actually having a chance to win that title. If it's immediately taken off of him by somebody else. Because Jey Uso is not going to be the WWE champion, but for maybe a few short minutes. Like Yokozuna the first time he won it. LA Knight, though, is somebody who I could see having a run or two with the top title. Or, of course, WWE could do what WWE does, and LA Knight wins the briefcase, cashes in, and fails. That is equally as possible. But again, you have up to a year to cash in. So we're talking about SummerSlam, and it doesn't have to be at SummerSlam. It could be at WrestleMania next year. It could be even after WrestleMania. You got a year to cash in. So there's a lot of different ways they could go with this. The other Money in the Bank qualifier on Friday saw Lacey Evans, who has completed her Sergeant Slaughter cosplay right down to the hat, completely dominating Zelina Vega until Vega hit a code red out of nowhere and pinned her. So Zelina is in, and on SmackDown this Friday, we're getting four more qualifying matches with Mia Yim against Bayley, Io Sky against Shotzi, Baron Corbin against Butch, and Santos Escobar against Mustafa Ali. Let me talk about Alexa Bliss here real quick. Some news that broke this week. Alexa Bliss has not wrestled a match since her loss to Bianca Belair at this year's Royal Rumble. Now we know that she will not be wrestling at next year's Royal Rumble either, or any other time soon. E! Online broke the news that Alexa is pregnant, and she and her husband Ryan Cabrera are expecting their first child in December. Bliss fan in absolute shambles right now. First, Roman Reigns kills Bray Wyatt and buries him at the Alamo, and now this. He will be keeping vigil on the live streams this week. I will light a candle. The couple said that it was a total surprise, since they weren't even trying, but they are very excited. The pregnancy bug has bitten a few wrestlers recently. Carmella, who announced on Tamron Hall show this week that she and Corey Graves are having a boy. Ty Mello and Sammy Guevara announced last weekend at Double or Nothing that they are having their first child soon. And now Alexa. I also saw it mentioned that so many women Asuka has worked with have since gotten pregnant. First it was Becky Lynch, then it was Lacey Evans, then it was Carmella, and now Alexa. I think there's something in that mist. It's not Sierra Mist, that's for sure. But there's something in that mist. I would be on high alert right now if I was Montez Ford. Alexa also told the Messenger website that the timing worked out perfectly for her because she had already taken some time off from WWE to prep for The Masked Singer. She said, WWE gave me time off for Masked Singer to kind of fully dive into that experience with rehearsals and vocal lessons and all that stuff. Storyline-wise, I was not on TV anyway, so it really kind of worked out perfectly. They extended my contract, and so it's just basically come back when I'm ready. Probably a month after the baby, I'll start probably getting into the gym and getting ready to see what my in-ring return looks like. So that's the first that we have heard of her contract being extended, which sounds like they froze her existing deal for the time missed, not that she signed a new deal. So congrats to the happy couple. You know, Alexa is going to be stuck at home now for the next 9 months at least. I'm sure she's going to be watching a lot of television. So perhaps she should listen up here because this week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. You know, I use Netflix like I'm sure many of you do. I'm sure Alexa does too. Netflix has all different kinds of shows and movies to watch depending on what part of the world you live in. Tens of thousands. But do you know that you're only getting access to a fraction of what they have to offer? Watching Netflix without ExpressVPN is like paying for a gym membership but only being able to use the treadmill. You see people on the other side of the room doing dumbbell squats with free weights, but you can't because they're not available in your part of the room. That sounds pretty stupid, doesn't it? Here's how ExpressVPN can open up access to all of this other content. It lets you change your location online, so you get to control where Netflix thinks you're located. And with almost 100 different server locations, think of all the new shows you can suddenly gain access to. And it works with other streaming services too, not just Netflix. I've tried it myself many times. It works great. I've used ExpressVPN to watch Pulp Fiction on Netflix Canada and Jurassic World on Netflix in Hong Kong. And I have never stepped foot in Hong Kong a day in my life. I am sure it is very nice there, but I wouldn't know. I only traveled there from my living room, and you can too. Just open the ExpressVPN app, choose a location, tap one button to connect, and refresh the page to open up a whole new library of content. ExpressVPN offers fast speeds with zero buffering. It's compatible on all of your devices and has a neat little bonus. It encrypts your data so you can browse the web securely. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/solomonster. Use my link at expressvpn.com/solomonster to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Tony Khan finally made it official on Wednesday. CM Punk is returning to AEW. As part of AEW Collision, starting with the debut episode on June 17th from the United Center in Chicago, he won't have very far to travel. He'll get to sleep in his own bed that night. There was no mention of what he would be doing on the show. The belief, per the Observer, is that Punk and Ace Steel will be heavily involved in the creative of the show going forward, at least for Punk stuff. And the main angles and storylines on the show will revolve around him. So make no mistake, Collision is the CM Punk show. And it sounds like he's going to have a whole lot of creative freedom on that show. It's going to be his playground. The bigger story here wasn't so much that Punk is coming back, I mean, we already knew that, but the very mixed reaction that he got in San Diego. A lot of cheers, but also a lot of noticeable boos, and that's from people who are actually in the building saying that also, not just the way it came across on television. Now, they were in California, which is the Young Bucks' backyard, so that also played a role, I'm sure. Punk is going to be greeted like a king in Chicago. The real test is going to be week 2, and 3, and 4, and so on. And those next few weeks of Collision after Chicago, they're in Canada, which is Kenny Omega's territory. They don't return to the States until July 22nd in Newark. You know, Punk is one of those guys who, as great of a babyface as he can be, he's an even better heel. If he gets booed in most places outside of Chicago, they would be wise to play into it and book Punk like a modern-day 1997 Bret Hart, where he's a babyface in Chicago, and he plays heel everywhere else, right? Not unlike MJF in Long Island, whenever they go to Long Island for Dynamite. Now, the only issue with that is there are more heels for him to work with than babyfaces. You know, Joe, great heel. Andrade, heel. Malakai Black, who was also on the Collision poster with the rest of the House of Black, heel. His boys, FTR, they're babyfaces. You know, maybe he ends up like their John Cena, where he gets mixed reactions wherever he goes. It's too early to tell, but Punk in that 1997 Bret Hart role I think could be fun to watch. And he's a big Bret mark. I'm sure he would love to do it at some point. You're not going to get a war of words or a program with Punk and the Elite. They've all signed NDA, so they can't talk about any of that stuff that went down. The Bucks clearly do not want to have anything to do with this man. My sense of Omega, based on comments he's made in interviews, is that he would be willing to do business and work with Punk, but again, they're keeping all of these guys separate. Tony Khan is not going to be able to keep them separate on the pay-per-views. They're going to be backstage. They're going to have to share a locker room together for those shows. I still think it's a time bomb waiting to explode doing it this way, without having any sort of resolution between all the parties involved. But that's the risk that Tony Khan is taking by bringing back CM Punk right now. You know, he wants Collision to be a success because it is something the head of Warner Brothers Discovery specifically, personally asked for. More wrestling, more AEW television on Saturday nights. It's not an easy night to do TV. He knows he needs a marquee name like Punk to have a fighting chance. Even with CM Punk, there is no guarantee this show is going to be able to pull great numbers after those first few weeks when the novelty wears off. In the 24 hours after the announcement of Punk's return, they moved an extra 500 or so tickets for the Chicago show. Which is all right. It's not great. You know, they're set up right now for around 10,000 in that building. They had closer to 15,000 tickets sold for the first dance 2 years ago. Out of those 10,000 that are open, they have over 7,700, and maybe by now it's 8,000. I haven't checked in the last 24 hours, but last I checked, they had about 7,700 tickets out for that United Center show. So they should be able to get 10K in there once they announce some matches and what Punk is going to be doing on the show. Their allotment of tickets, I'm sure, will sell out. We'll see how many more they sell for those Canadian dates. Again, those first three or four collisions after Chicago that Punk is going to be on are all up north. They're all up in Canada. So we'll see how that sells. The other question when it comes to Punk is his health. He broke his foot. He shattered it on that dumb stage dive right after he won the AEW World title for the first time. And it ruined an entire summer's worth of storylines that Tony Khan had planned for him heading into Forbidden Door last year and beyond Forbidden Door. He came back, and then less than 2 weeks later, he wins back the AEW World title and tears his triceps in the same match. So whether Brawl Out happened or not, we were going to get a vacant championship. Now, it could be dumb luck, or it could be something else. You know, he's a lot older than people remember him being. it's a risk. Building an entire show around someone coming off two major injuries and two major surgeries. Can he stay healthy? It's one of the reasons that there's a lot of reasons why I would keep him away from that AEW world title. But it's one of the reasons why Tony Khan should not consider putting the belt back on Punk. If he wrestles MJF again, it should be to lose and put him over. Not to win the AEW world title. That should be out of the question right now. I remember Dax Harwood claimed that Punk told him once he didn't even want to be the AEW world champion the first time. But Tony Khan felt like it would help the company for them to have the belt on Punk because Punk had a name. So Punk said, okay, if you think it'll be good for the company, I'll be your champion. The first time, they had to create an interim title. The second time, they had to hold a tournament. So I hope Punk keeps that same attitude this time around. I agree with him. He doesn't need the AEW world title. That should not even be part of the conversation. They put the belt on him twice. They got burned twice. There is no need to try again. He does not need the belt. But Fightful is reporting that heavy pitches for Chris Jericho to work with Punk were made. If you remember, they had their meeting in Florida to try to hash things out. That was the trip where Punk ended up on the same flight coming back to Chicago as some of the WWE talent. And he ended up backstage at Raw. Pitches were made. Fightful, though, has not heard anything new on that front. Samoa Joe against CM Punk was planned at one point, is still in the works. But word now is that Punk has taken a liking to the work of Switchblade Jay White. And that Jay White could be an early opponent or program for Punk, along with Bullet Club Gold. That would explain why FTR came to Ricky Starks' rescue against Bullet Club Gold. You know, Jay White and Ricky Starks, they're wrestling this Wednesday. FTR banned from ringside. Juice Robinson banned from ringside. I think we're getting a third member of Bullet Club Gold revealed. At least one, maybe two. I think we're getting that on Wednesday. I think they're going to help Jay White win that match. And I could see a CMFTR, maybe with Ricky Starks, against Bullet Club Gold feud on Collision. They have to add more members. You cannot have Bullet Club or Bullet Club offshoot with only two people. Two people does not a faction make. That's a tag team, not a faction. So they have to add at least one new member to Bullet Club Gold. I think we get that this week. Elsewhere on Dynamite, they teased that Kenny Omega went back home after Double or Nothing, but all Hangman Page would confirm is that he did not go home to Canada. And the implication I read into that being that he may have gone to Japan. You know, he's got friends there. He's got one friend in particular, a certain Golden Lover, who I think would help even the playing field very nicely for a future Blood and Guts match. Later in the show, Don Callis and Konosuke Takeshita, they came to the ring. They were drowned out by booze. You would have thought it was Shawn Michaels in the ring in Montreal in 2005. Only Callis screwed over a different Canadian. The heat for them, especially Callis, was off the charts. Adam Cole may be done with Chris Jericho after beating him at Double or Nothing. He beat him again on Wednesday in a mixed tag match with Britt Baker against Jericho and Saraya. I liked the tag match a hell of a lot more than I did their unsanctioned match. The unsanctioned match was a bust last Sunday. Some people tried to blame it on the crowd. You can't just lay that on the at the crowd's feet. I just did not think that match was very good. It was a bust. The one on Wednesday was a lot better. And the best part? There was no 50-50 booking. Adam Cole beat Chris Jericho twice. And now he can move on to something else. I don't think they're going to get to Cole and MJF just yet. I think that's something they're going to hold off for All Out. But I do think that's the direction. I do think Adam Cole is being built for an eventual championship match with MJF. Chris Statlander returned after 9 months away from the ring with an ACL tear to take the TBS title at Double or Nothing from Jade Cargill last Sunday. Mark Sterling, after Jade's win over Taya Valkyrie, got in the ring. They threw out an open challenge, and out came Chris Statlander to open the challenge. She became the one in 60-1, handing Jade her first loss, winning her first championship. On Wednesday, she worked her first match on Dynamite since January of last year and successfully defended her title against Nyla Rose. Jade is said to be taking time off, and they're going to retool her character when she returns, whatever that means. Could be a babyface turn. Maybe she dumps Mark Sterling and blames him for costing her the title. Maybe she links up with the AEW originals in their feud with the Outcasts. Right? Jade is as much a homegrown talent as any of them. Britt Baker, Sheeta, Jamie Hayter. But there would have to be a story. The Outcasts have had nothing to do with Jade. Why would Jade all of a sudden see fit to fight them? I'm thinking about it because I've seen talk online of there also being a women's blood and guts match. Or that there should be a women's blood and guts match. If they're going to do one for the men, they should do one for the women. And I've said before, I don't agree with that. If there's a story, if there's a strong enough feud for the women to necessitate there being a blood and guts match, then fine, do a blood and guts match. Don't just do one, though, with them for the sake of doing it. But if they do it, if it's 4-on-4 or if it's 5-on-5, Jade would fit right in on the side of the originals. Swerve Strickland is challenging Orange Cassidy for the AEW International title on Dynamite this week. People have been predicting Cassidy's demise for weeks. This fucker has held onto that belt, though, like he's a cockroach. He's like TNA. He just won't die. Cassidy already eliminated Swerve in the Battle Royal last Sunday. Are they going to have him pin Swerve also and beat him again? You know, gun to head, if I had to predict, I think we're getting a new international champion this week. MJF was not on the show on Wednesday, save for a pre-taped promo backstage at Double or Nothing after his win in the Four Pillars match. A match that, if that match does not make my top 15 matches list this year, then that means we had a really damn good year for wrestling matches, because that is one of the best matches that you will ever see as far as four-ways go. MJF was even saying, oh, it's the best four-way of all time. You know what? Off the top of my head, I can't think of a better one. Maybe if I had time to sit here and think it through, I could find one, but off the top of my head, I can't think of one better. In this promo, though, he talked about having no competition. He said AEW was running out of gladiators. And then I got an email from someone wondering if that reference could be a reference to Bill Goldberg coming to AEW to wrestle MJF. If he comes in, because Tony Khan has been open about the fact that he likes Bill, he considers him a friend, they've chatted, they've had conversations before. I guess he also knows him from the Jacksonville area and stuff, or maybe charity work he's done. But so he's talked about this, and Bill Goldberg's a free agent. So I'm sure that he and Tony Khan have had at least a phone conversation. If he comes in and he puts MJF over, it's just, you know, I think I'm done with the Goldberg stuff as far as wrestling for world titles. He does not need to be challenging for world titles anymore. But I've said before, if Tony Khan wanted Goldberg as an attraction for Wembley, let's say, to put over somebody like Wardlow, then that's fine. If he puts over MJF, fine. But do we really need Goldberg wrestling for the world championship in 2023? That was a rhetorical question, by the way. The answer is no. No, we do not. And the first images and gameplay have dropped of Owen Hart in AEW Fight Forever, which is out on June 29th. There's been a lot of gameplay videos that have dropped, but the Owen Hart stuff, I just saw that yesterday for the first time. The more gameplay I see for this, by the way, the more hyped I get for it. It looks like it's a lot of fun. I think Owen Hart, CM Punk, and Cody Rhodes are all in the game. I know Cody is. Punk, I'm not sure of. I think Punk still is in the game. I know he's off the cover. What a mess, by the way. They had him front and center on the cover of the game because they thought it would help sell video games. Then Brawl Out happened, and he got replaced. And now he's back before the game even comes out. But the Owen stuff I saw looked really good. They had all kinds of cutscenes with him in their story mode. And what's cool about that, I guess, from what I read, is that, you know, you have like Tony Khan is on the phone having a conversation with a wrestler who's got Tony on speakerphone. And I guess the dialogue will change depending on who the person is, how big of a star they are. So I'm very curious to kind of get hands on with their story mode. I think they call it Road to the Elite. So again, I'm watching this and it was weird watching Owen holding an iPhone. It's amazing. He's been gone for so long. Smartphones were not even a thing when he was still alive. But already, I'm seeing the Brigade of Morons out in full force. Oh, how dare AEW make money off the good name of Owen Hart? How disgusting. How low can you go? And the only reason Martha is doing it is for the money. Yes, yes, of course. Of course. It's all about the money with Martha Hart. That's why she resisted the chance to work with WWE for over 20 years. You know, the billion-dollar company, when she could have made more money than you'll ever make in a lifetime. Yes, I'm sure it's all about the money. She's working with AEW and not WWE because AEW did not kill her husband. And because she wants nothing to do with the McMahon family, which is completely understandable. And in case you missed it last year, they announced at that time that the Owen Hart Cup and all the Owen merchandise, t-shirts, they have Jazzwear figures, his inclusion in the video game, it's all part of a collaboration with the Owen Hart Foundation. The Owen Hart Foundation helps with scholarships, housing, other programs. Anything to shit on AEW, though. Oh, he never worked for AEW. How dare they? It's a mockery of his leg. I mean, are you fucking serious? Let's just call it what it is. It's all about shitting on AEW. The only people who have this much of an issue, a year later still, with Owen Hart being included in the game and having any sort of affiliation with this company is because they look for excuses to shit on this company. Even the mutants can take something nice and try to turn it into something dark. So to all those people, you know, it's almost summertime, right? June is here. The weather is getting warmer. People are hitting the beach. They're swimming in their pool. Splish splash. Your opinion is trash. Shut the fuck up.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet, and when this episode with Solid Monster is done, go check out my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet. More specifically, check out my recent episode with Will Ospreay on Insight with Chris Van Vliet. We talk about how his contract with New Japan is ending in the new year, and I mean, what's next for him? Is it renewing with New Japan? Is it going to AEW? It's definitely not going to WWE, and he explains all of the details about that. Also, I interviewed the voice of NXT, Vic Joseph, and some of my recent interviews include Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Undertaker, Eric Bischoff, Ty Valkyrie, Ric Flair, woo, and so many more. You can find Insight with Chris Van Vliet wherever you're listening to this podcast right now.
Other news and notes, Will Ospreay sat down with Chris Van Vliet, as you heard Chris talk about just a few seconds ago. Ospreay's been open about the fact that his contract with New Japan expires in February of next year, which has led to people wondering if he might make the jump full-time to the U.S. to work for WWE or for AEW. He's already made a bunch of appearances for AEW, but he put all the speculation to rest by saying he expects to come to terms on a new deal that would keep him in New Japan, the main reason being he absolutely, positively does not want to move to the United States. That is his red line. It is non-negotiable. If he would have to move to the States, then he's not going there. He said, I just don't want to live in America. That's my full stop thing. I'm basically saying we'll sort something out. That's in reference to him in New Japan. Ospreay's already been an IWGP World Heavyweight Champion, although that run got cut short due to a neck injury. He's held the IWGP US title and it probably is about to hold it again. Junior heavyweight title, the never open weight title, he won the New Japan Cup, he's headlined the Tokyo Dome, he's done a lot of things, he's accomplished nearly everything there is to do in New Japan, although he's never won the G1. I still think this year is the year it happens. So he's already accomplished a lot there. Chris asked him, what's left? What's left for you to accomplish there? And this is what Ospreay said. I just like doing it. I can always reinvent. I can always change it up. Right now, the United Empire is real hot. Merchandise sales with us are real good in Japan. Like, we're the number one faction in New Japan, voted by Tokyo Sports and fans. I can feel something that it wasn't the best start of the United Empire because of COVID and everything. There was no reason for myself, Okan, Jeff Cobb, and Aaron Hanare to be put together, but we just made it work. There was a bunch of things that always happened, but in the end, we finally got all the group together. 10 jewels make the crown. So I can't walk around in Japan now without at least being stopped once or twice a day with people doing the United Empire hand sign. If Ospreay stays with New Japan, that means he can still work with AEW and at least work these Forbidden Door shows every year. So the way I look at it, it's a win-win. Takami Obari, the president of New Japan Pro Wrestling, sat down with ProRes Today for an interview about the company and just how close they came to closing their doors for good during the pandemic. Things were more dire than we even knew. He says, I try to look at sales separately inside and outside the venue, especially because of the Corona disaster. Inside sales are tickets and merchandise sales, which at one point were down 60% due to the decline in attendance. Even in the most recent year, it's still down about 40%. It's only back up to 60%. If we had continued with our existing business portfolio, I think the company would have ceased to exist within a few months. The majority of our business was dependent on revenues from the venue. One day, Tanahashi asked me, Boss, if this situation continues, how many more months will this company last? I could count on one hand. At the time, I could count on one hand. With a smile on my face, I replied, Don't worry. And he said they're at a point now where this will probably be their second largest year as far as sales go. He said they're at a level where they can turn a profit, although it's barely. They can barely turn a profit. He says, during the pandemic, the inside sales fell by a frightening double-digit billion yen. But we are now at a point where we can cover about 70 to 80% of that amount with our outside business. As mentioned, in terms of sales scale, the current fiscal year ending in June will probably be the second largest in our 50-year history. However, ticket revenue is a fixed-cost business, and after covering that, almost all of it is profit. A decrease in attendance means that only the most profitable part of the business is lost, and in terms of profit, we are just barely able to reach a level where we can turn a profit. He talked about the cost-cutting measures they took to avoid disaster. When he became president, that was in October of 2020. He was the one, if you remember, who replaced Harold Mage. And once Mage was gone, that's when relations with AEW started to finally thaw. There was still a lot of ill feelings on the Elite side towards Mage from when they left to go start AEW. Obari said, we arranged for tests and vaccines. We also made internal rules, and the recently abolished guidelines were the first edition written word for word to protect customers, wrestlers, and others involved from the virus. In terms of expenses, we made various cost-cutting measures, which we called winter preparations. After assuming the presidency, I canceled the president's car, moved to a low-cost office building, imposed cross-quotes and price negotiations on all contracts, and recommended low-cost airline flights, which are cheaper than bullet trains, for business trips. Of course, we also asked wrestlers and employees to be patient in terms of treatment. Many employees left the company, but we never replaced them. And everyone worked together to make it happen. Looking back, the success of the Double Dome was a big break from the boom time, so we had to make a drastic change. And we had to build, or rebuild, rather, from a financial standpoint. However, that is the advantage of being a small company. If management is serious, it can turn things around and make changes all at once. Believing this, we changed our position in the face of a strong headwind, using the Corona disaster as a lever to grow as fast as we could. As a result, this has borne fruit over the past 3 years, and I believe this fiscal year, which ends in June, will be the second highest in New Japan Pro Wrestling's history in terms of sales. New Japan, at times, I mean, felt like the only major company that took COVID seriously. I mean, they were very strict when it came to testing. Especially, you know, they didn't let any talent go when financially it would have made sense for them to do so and make cuts. They didn't let any wrestlers go. The executives took pay cuts so that they didn't have to fire any of the wrestlers. And I think Tony Khan also did the same. And then at WWE, of course, they fired dozens of wrestlers. I think Tony Khan tried to also resist firing anybody. But I mean, how many promotions here would have done that? You know, because their business is so dependent on ticket sales, I mean, way more than WWE and AEW are, they really got kicked in the ass by this thing. It's very different in Japan than it is here when it comes to television rights money. It doesn't work the same way over there. They don't have these massive million and billion dollar contracts for television rights, which is really how WWE makes most of its money. WWE makes most of its money from NBC Universal and Fox. And they have that billion dollar deal with Peacock for the network. That's how the majority of their money is made. You know, New Japan doesn't have anything like that. None of the promotions do in that part of the world. Now, Will Ospreay, he sounds confident that he'll re-sign with New Japan, but they're not really in a position to be doling out big money contracts to anybody right now. It makes more sense now that they would let Aussie Open walk and go to AEW. They probably just couldn't afford them. They couldn't afford what they were looking for. So now they're signed to AEW and they can still work New Japan if they want to. They can work tours over there. Tetsuya Naito last year claimed he took a 24% pay cut in his salary to re-sign with New Japan when they were still reeling from the pandemic. Someone like Mercedes Moné, I mean, that was a Bushiroad deal. That's not a New Japan deal. So whatever money they're paying her, that does not come out of New Japan's budget. But speaking of Mercedes, New Japan is under the impression that her injury is a severely sprained ankle, not a broken ankle. Those close to her have said there is definitely a sprain, but the fear of a break is still very real, and there was too much swelling still to know for sure, and they're hoping to have a clearer picture of where things stand after the swelling has gone down. Now, I'm no doctor or lab technician, but I find it odd that they can't by now say through an X-ray or an MRI whether there's a break or not. I mean, it's been a few weeks, so I find that strange. I know that a severe sprain, it can be just as bad as a break, depending on the type of break. So even if it's only sprained, it could still be a few months before we see her back in the ring. But obviously, that's great news. If it's not broken and she doesn't need surgery, that's a great thing. And here's a wild story. It's actually been out there for years, but now we finally have an answer to the question. Is Sweet Stan Lane, one half of the Fabulous Ones, one half of the Midnight Express, really the biological father of Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert? This is a real thing that has been talked about now for years. And for those who don't know the story, Boebert's mother had sex with Stan Lane in 1986, around the time that he would have been working in the Florida territory. And later that year, out popped Lauren Boebert. Boebert and her mother, they both believed for years that Stan Lane was her father. And a paternity test in 1990 that ruled him out as a father, as the father, may have been fraudulently handled. Apparently, the technician who took Lane's blood sample was later convicted of taking a $500 bribe to switch samples in a different case involving an NFL player. Lane was never retested, even though it was mandated, but he was never retested. So no effort, or Boebert's mother claims she was never notified of this. So there was no effort made to retest him. Years later, when she learned about this, she tried going after him again and has been doing so ever since. Wanted him to pay child support. Well, yesterday, PW Insider received a press release from Sal Corrente. He was the guy who used to run those Wrestle Reunion conventions. I went to the last one they ever did in Miami in 2012. That's where I got to meet Bobby Heenan. He said he's a longtime friend and associate of Stan Lane. He is fully authorized to release the following statement. This is the only statement that Stan is going to make on this matter, and I will read you now what Stan Lane wrote. My name is Stan Lane. I have had two professional careers, one in the world of professional wrestling and the other as an announcer for many years in powerboat racing. Early in my wrestling career, while I was living in Florida and working for Championship Wrestling from Florida, I received notice that a woman I had a short affair with was accusing me of fathering her child. We went through the legal system and completed a court-ordered paternity test. I was declared not to be the father, and the case was dismissed. In spite of the court verdict, the mother of the child, who turned out to be Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, her mother has continued to stick to her original claim. I agreed to take another DNA paternity test with Lauren Boebert in May of 2023. I allowed Lauren to handle the chain of custody for the samples to alleviate any doubt with the results. The results came back on May 11th. They were conclusive that I had a 0.0% chance of being the biological father. Once we both reviewed the results, Lauren and I agreed that this matter is settled, and I accepted Lauren's apology on behalf of herself and her mother. The situation and numerous false claims made against me over the years has been stressful for me and my family. I feel my otherwise good reputation has been tarnished considerably. I and other close members of my inner circle have been dragged into this as well. I have also been followed by the news media so that they could get the scoop on this topic. I ask that I be taken out of this equation since a conclusive result has been given to both sides. While I was fortunate to have a career in the spotlight for 30-plus years, it is my desire to step back and enjoy my retirement with my wife. My interactions with Ms. Boebert have been pleasant and enjoyable. I wish Lauren all the best in her future endeavors. If she continues the search for her biological father, I hope she finds the answers that she has been looking for. Signed, Stan Lane. And in the article, he included photos of text messages that Boebert sent him and a picture of her holding a FedEx envelope and smiling, and then a screenshot of the DNA testing results. Well, I'm glad he can finally put that to bed, as he apparently did many a female back in the day. NXT Battleground was the odd man out last weekend. As far as the pay-per-view recaps went, it ran head-to-head with Double or Nothing, and I have since watched it, and it was a good show. I enjoyed it. It wasn't the show of the weekend, but I had fun with it. The opening three-way for the North American title I thought was very good, with Wesley retaining over Tyler Bate and Joe Gacy. Gacy impressed me in that match, but I still would have preferred this to be a one-on-one. This should have been Tyler Bate, Wesley, one-on-one. Since Gacy took the losing fall, we may be getting that anyway soon. Noam Dar retained his Heritage Cup over Dragon Lee, as I figured he would, with the help of some interference in the later rounds. It looks like he's got his own faction now. With Aura Mensa, Jakara Jackson, and Lash Legend. I'm not a huge fan of the Heritage Cup rules, but at least it's something different. There was a terrifying spot in that match in the fifth round, because these things go six rounds. In the fifth round of this match, Noam Dar countered an over-the-top Hurricanrana attempt by Dragon Lee, who had pulled it off earlier in the match, and he went to the well again. This time, Dar stuffed it. He took him, basically the way I could describe it is, he turned it into a powerbomb. Lee took a nasty powerbomb all the way to the floor, and I think he hit the apron on the way down too. That may have actually slowed the momentum a little bit, but this looked horrifying. Thankfully, he was okay, but that was a very scary spot. And in the end, Noam Dar holds on to the Heritage Cup. The Ilya Dragunov-Dijak Last Man Standing match was the best thing on the entire show. It was a spectacle of brutality. Dragunov got a little bit of blood by his mouth, but you know that these two would have loved to have had a bloody war. If this was in AEW, forget about it. You would not even be able to tell what color the actual canvas was. It would just be soaked in blood. They did all they could to kill each other without the blood. Dragunov had these nasty welts on his arm, these black and blues when it was over. I think they were even swelling. Dijak was just punishing this man in the corner with kendo stick shots, chair shots to the back. He would not stay down. No matter what he did to Dragunov, Dragunov would still get up. The ring steps were in the ring, and Dragunov set them upright, and he dove off of them with a flying forearm to a downed Dijak, who was already face down on the mat with a chair underneath him. And so he got knocked face first into the chair and he was out. And Dijak could not answer the 10 count. Dragunov is the last man standing. Just brutal. Brutal stuff from these two. There are reports that WWE is looking to call up Dragunov to the Raw roster later this summer as a new member of Imperium. And I don't know how I feel about that, because I don't think he needs to be in Imperium, but if it eventually leads to a split in Imperium and a Gunther Dragunov match or a Gunther Dragunov program, I'm all for it. Dragunov is the one who ended that long NXT UK championship run that Gunther was on, and the matches that they had two of them, I think. But the matches they had in NXT UK, and then I guess later NXT, were outstanding. And the idea of them being able to replicate that on the main roster is something I would be very interested in seeing. There's a whole audience who never saw any of those matches. So the idea that they could run it back, you'd have a lot of people who never saw these two work together before. You know, on the main roster, I think they would absolutely tear the house down and get people invested in that match. So maybe that's how they start. You know, they throw him into Imperium. Like I said, I'm not sure he needs to be part of that group. I'm not sure if he replaces someone, if they turn it into a four-man faction, but that's the rumor. Right now, it's just a rumor going around. Gallus retained the NXT tag team titles over the Creed brothers. A decent match. Nothing that really stands out about it. Other than the fact that Ivy Nile outside the ring got attacked by Ava Rain, which sets up Ava's first singles feud. Tiffany Stratton is the new NXT Women's Champion, beating Lyra Valkyria. They played up the knee injury the Valkyria suffered on TV at the hands of Cora Jade. It's too bad she didn't have a titanium knee brace like the titanium cast that Cody had at Night of Champions. That might have helped her. They made the wrong call, not having Roxanne Perez in the finals against Tiffany. I mean, Tiffany was always going to be the winner here. But there would have been more drama. I think it would have made for a better match with a less predictable outcome. They had a good match, though. I mean, Stratton already has maybe the best moonsault in the business. She's very green. She's still very inexperienced. But her moonsault, basically she took Chris Daniels' best moonsault ever. I mean, find me a better moonsault right now in the business. You know, there may be one, but hers is up there. I thought it would happen at WrestleMania weekend, but that belt was going to find its way around her waist soon enough. And now she's the face of the women's division. Now they can build around her. And Carmelo Hayes beat Bron Breakker again. This time it was heel Bron that he beat, who does some of the same trash talking that his uncle used to do during his matches. I like that. That midair spear, when he caught Carmelo Hayes coming off that springboard from the middle rope, and he turned in midair, and Braun just speared the ever-loving shit out of him. Wow. Bron Breakker, hey, he delivers the best spear since Bill Goldberg. Bar none. I know some people are going to say Rhino. They're going to throw Rhino's name at me. Rhino's gore was great. But I've never seen a person deliver a spear with the explosiveness and the intensity that Bron Breakker has since Bill Goldberg in his prime. It looks like absolute death every time he hits it. And this one, in any other circumstance, should have been the finish. But you can't have him take the title back from Carmelo Hayes after a month. You just can't do that. Bron doesn't need the title anymore anyway. Right now, he's just fine-tuning his heel persona until Triple H has a spot ready for him on the main roster. Because he's ready. You know, he's ready to be called up. You know, I got an email the other day from somebody asking me if he should be rocketed to the main event scene when he gets called up. No. I think that would be a big mistake. Call him up. Let him start just ripping through people. And let him have a solid run first with one of the mid-card titles. You know, if they take their time with him, they'll have a new main event star in their hands by WrestleMania 42. As far as Carmelo Hayes, this was needed. He already beat Bron Breakker once, but it was with an assist from Trick Williams. He needed to do this on his own, and that's what he did. And this felt more like a passing of the torch type moment to signal a new era in NXT than their last match did. I think their stand and deliver match was better until the finish. If you can combine the body of the first match with the closing minutes of this one, you would have a great match. So some quick thoughts on NXT from Tuesday, and then we'll do Dark Side of the Ring. Gigi Dolin and JC Jane, they finally made it through a full match without somebody getting injured. This was their weaponized cage match. Gigi picks up the win. It was the best of all the matches they've had, and it should be their last. It's time for both of them to finally move on to other things. There was a backstage segment where Reggie, no longer doing the Scripps gimmick with the mask. This was after he was unmasked recently by Axiom a few weeks ago. He approached Axiom in the back, and he tried to be very friendly. And Axiom asked Reggie what he wanted. And he said that, yes, Reggie is my given name, but my people called me Scripps. And Axiom was confused what he meant when he said my people. He asked him, your family? And Reggie said, they were most definitely not my family. And then he said, that's a story for another day. Now, I bring this up because I wasn't aware until just recently that Reggie, when he was in high school, he joined the Crips gang. He quit that life. He went back to the circus. He had joined, you know, he was doing circus stuff when he was 11 years old. So he quit the gang life and he went back to the circus stuff. I had no idea he was a member of the Crips. Here, it sounded like maybe he was referencing that and they were going to come back to it and talk more about his real life story, similar to what they're doing now with Von Wagner, you know, incorporating those photos of him as a child with the scars on his head, with Robert Stone trying to get him to open up more about what happened to him. I'm all for that. I think incorporating more of their real-life story into their characters, especially since, you know, what they were doing with them already wasn't working, I think that's a great thing if that's the direction they're going in. Mustafa Ali was the first of two main roster free agents to appear on this show. He randomly appeared in the crowd and came down to do commentary for a tag match with Wesley and Tyler Bate against the Dyad. The Babyfaces picked up the win. Joe Gacy attacked after the match. That led to Ali coming to clear out Gacy. He stood with Bate and Lee. On commentary, Ali said that wrestling Gunther at Night of Champions only made him more obsessed with winning a championship. So it sounds like he's got his eyes on that North American title. Blair Davenport, the former Bea Priestley, is back. She was revealed to be the hooded figure who's been attacking some of the women, including Sol Ruka, a few weeks ago. The best part of this was Vic Joseph on commentary. After she pulled the hood down and revealed herself, Vic Joseph is on commentary telling Booker T, "Booker, that's Blair Davenport." And Booker T, for the first time I think in his life, had nothing to say. He said nothing. He went silent. Like, he had no idea who this woman, I guarantee he had no idea who this woman was. So he just wasn't going to say anything. NXT lost Indy Hartwell. They lost a few of the other women to the draft. So getting Davenport back is a good way to start replacing some of the names that they lost. They still have a lot of talent down in that women's division. This Tuesday, they're holding a battle royal to determine a number one contender for Tiffany Stratton's title. I thought Carmelo Hayes against Noam Dar was a very good outing for both men. Hayes picks up another win. But then post-match, he's in the aisleway. He's got his back turned. And he gets jumped from behind by Baron Corbin. Another free agent sighting here on this show. He laid out Hayes with what I have to say, to give him credit, maybe the best looking end of days that I've ever seen. And I credit Hayes a lot for the sell job on that. And Corbin posed with the NXT championship to close out the show. I don't have a problem with them occasionally having main roster talent drop in to put over the younger guys, or if they have someone like Corbin who's colder than a corpse on the main roster, go to NXT to try to reinvent himself or rehabilitate himself. But how are you going to take this guy who has been booked like a loser since SummerSlam and who just lost to Cameron Grimes in 4 seconds a few weeks ago and have him lay out the NXT champion and presumably now challenge for the NXT title very soon? On his first night in, he lays out Hayes and holds up the NXT championship. So you know we're going to get the match. How does that do Carmelo Hayes any favors? I've seen people online all week go, "Oh, Lone Wolf, Lone Wolf, Lone Wolf, the Lone Wolf is back." It's the same Baron Corbin that you see on television every few weeks who has failed at every turn, no matter what they've done with him. The man who retired Kurt Angle, what a great decision that was. It's the same person. Now, maybe in NXT, they can breathe some new life back into his lungs. But I saw this and I just groaned. This is what Nick Khan was talking about at that JP Morgan conference, using more main roster talent to give NXT a boost. You know, Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander, they're also free agents coming out of the draft. Maybe we'll see them challenge Gallus for the tag team titles. Dark Side of the Ring returned this week, opening its fourth season with an episode on Chris Candido and Tammy Sitch. And I thought it was excellent. Very emotional stuff with Chris. We had Jim Cornette, Lance Storm, and Dr. Tom Pritchard, and Chris's brother Johnny all breaking down at one point when they talked about Chris's death, because it was just so shocking and so tragic the way it happened. Chris Jericho is back as the narrator for this season. Mick Foley, who narrated the Bruiser Brody episode in the first season, he was also interviewed, as was Terry Runnels, and Chris Candido's mom, Peggy. And because, on advice of her lawyers, we were told, Tammy Sitch did not sit for an interview with the producers. I mean, that might be hard. I don't know how much time they give you behind the glass when you go visit somebody in fucking jail, but on advice of her lawyers, she did not speak to the producers. We got portions, though, of two shoot interviews that she did, one in 2006 and another one in 2020, spliced in with subtitles. So we didn't see her, but we heard her voice on this show. I like that they kept the focus primarily on Chris, who a lot of people probably don't know too much about. And you know there are a lot of people watching this show who don't even know who he is at all, as compared to Tammy, who is a complete train wreck. And everybody knows what an embarrassment she turned out to be. So I like that they kept the focus on Chris to let people know who he is and let him know, or let us know, more about his story. There was an interview with one of the producers where they said they considered making this a two-part episode with more of a focus on Tammy in the second episode. But between her issues and her lawyers constantly butting in and getting involved and trying to protect what was left of her image, they decided against it. Forget a two-parter. They could have gotten an entire season's worth of material out of Tammy alone. You could have made season four the season of Tammy Sitch. So, Chris Candido, he was a hardcore wrestling fan. He was a wrestling geek, like many of us, from a very young age. He even started his own wrestling promotion when he was 12 years old, for him and his friends. And this, they did not mention any of this in the episode, but that is how he and Bam Bam Bigelow became friends. They knew each other from Spring Lake in New Jersey, where Chris lived, and Bam Bam lived in Asbury Park. But Bam Bam would help set up the ring. They got the ring from the Monster Factory. They would set it up, I guess, in Chris's backyard. Bam Bam even wrestled his first match for Chris's promotion. Balls Mahoney was part of that crew. He grew up a few blocks away from Candido and his brother. His brother Johnny showed off the belt that Chris made for the promotion. It looks better than the new belt they gifted to Roman Reigns on SmackDown this week. Chris met Tammy after he spotted her in the front row at a show that he was wrestling on. At the time she was in high school, they started dating. So now he had two obsessions, pro wrestling and Tammy. And his mother thought that Tammy was a very nice girl at the beginning when he first met her. From there, Chris ended up working in Smoky Mountain. That's where Jim Cornette met Tammy for the first time. Well, he met both of them for the first time, but he met Tammy, who had no interest in getting into the business. But he saw that she had some charisma. And clearly, she was a beautiful girl. And he came up with the idea to make her a manager. So that way, he could justify paying them both, because otherwise, it wouldn't have made sense for them to move from New Jersey all the way to Tennessee for what they were going to be making. He says, I'll pay this girl, but she can't wrestle, so let's try to make her a manager. And they played audio from Tammy in 2020 talking about how wrestling was Chris's thing and she wanted to be a plastic surgeon and just fell ass backwards into the wrestling business. Actually, she was pre-med and she was on her way to medical school before the two of them got hired by WWE. So at that point, she quit school to go out on the road. You know, a few years after she went into the WWE Hall of Fame, she talked about going back to school to finish her undergrad at NYU. She wanted to become a physician's assistant so that she could practice medicine and write prescriptions. What a fucking disaster that would have been. Can you imagine? Tammy Sitch being able to write prescriptions and being around pills all the time. Yeah, that would have ended great. So Cornette talked about Tennessee being a very ruby red, let's say, Republican area, and everybody hating the Clintons at the time. So to piss them off, he gave Tammy the character of a woman from New England who idolized Hillary Clinton. And that first promo she ever did, and they played part of it, the first promo she ever did, he said she nailed it in one take. She was a natural. She wasn't afraid of getting people to hate her. She wasn't afraid of getting heat. Tammy ended up getting more over than Chris did. Even though Chris was a hell of a worker, I mean, he didn't have the kind of charisma that Tammy had, or the other assets that she had, which is what got them their first gig in WWE, as the Body Donnas. They were two fitness gurus, which was a terrible gimmick in a long line of terrible gimmicks that Vince McMahon came up with during what I call his acid trip of 1995. So Chris dropped out of school to go to WWE because that was always his dream. He dreamed of becoming a world champion in WWE. He was never going to be the world champion, though, as a Body Donna. That dream died the moment he got saddled with that gimmick. That dream was dead. And they had him also do a storyline where he lost to Barry Horowitz, who was the perennial jobber to the stars. At that point, there was no chance that Chris Candido was ever going to be seen as any sort of main event level star in this company. He had no chance. And his size probably would have worked against him anyway. But even if you point to like Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels, they were never the biggest guys, but they became world champion. Yeah, but they were never saddled with a rotten mid-card gimmick like he was. So Terry Runnels talked about Sunny being the most downloaded female on AOL. Oh, she wasn't just the most downloaded female. That's underselling it. She was the most downloaded celebrity on the internet in 1996. That's according to America Online. Now, I know we have some people listening to this wondering, what's America Online? You people will never know the struggle of sitting here waiting 5 minutes for a single picture to download, pixel by pixel, until your mother picks up the phone to make a phone call and knocks you off the internet, and then you have to start all over again. And that noise, that dial-up noise, every time you would dial up, it sounded like a cat being mutilated. But they showed Sunny in the 90 playing pool, and I remember the pictures of Sunny in the American flag bikini rollerblading down the beach, the Raw magazine photos of Sunny wearing barely anything. It's not hard to see why this woman was so over. Meanwhile, Skip and Zip, they were barely employed. Skip and Zip, by this point, they were paired up as the Body Don as Sunny was managing them. Zip was Dr. Tom with a shaved head. They did win the tag team titles from the Godwins on the WrestleMania 12 pre-show, and that ended up being their big claim to fame in WWE. But Tammy came along at just the right time. Lance Storm said it here in the episode with the internet boom. She came along at just the right time. She took off. And then she got caught up in the party lifestyle on the road and with people she started hanging out with who were a bad influence on her, namely Shawn Michaels. Tammy says that she started seeing Shawn after she and Chris split up, but I have my doubts about that. It was an open secret in the locker room that Shawn Michaels and Sonny were fucking. There's even stories of Vince McMahon letting Shawn use his office at some of the buildings for the two of them to take care of business. Everyone knew about it. Everybody except Chris, apparently. I find that very hard to believe, that all of these people knew, and he didn't. So he probably did. But he didn't do anything about it because it was Shawn Michaels. He was the WWE champion at the time, the biggest star in the company. He was part of the clique. He knew that it would be career suicide if he did anything to him. And his goal was to be a big star in WWE. That's not going to happen if you beat up Shawn Michaels or if you threaten Shawn Michaels. So he just let it happen. And he probably lost a lot of respect from the other wrestlers because of that. Like, how can you let something like that go on? Right under your nose. And that was very unfair to Chris. It put him in a very difficult position. Terry said being loved by the top guy felt better to her than being loved by her boyfriend who was way down here. So then Chris breaks his neck in a match at Madison Square Garden, and he winds up hooked on pills. He's hooked on somas. And this is a guy who didn't even drink in a business where all you ever hear about from back in the day are drinking stories. It was like a rite of passage. Didn't drink, didn't do drugs. He ends up hooked on pills. And then ends up leaving and going to ECW, and he got over well in ECW without the dumb gimmick. They showed highlights of him giving Lance Storm his finish, which was a powerbomb from the top rope. He called it the Blonde Bombshell, named after Tammy. And he said they were, Lance said they were taking these moves every night. Candido would give him the Blonde Bombshell. Sometimes he would give Candido the Blonde Bombshell. It's brutal. I mean, you see their heads bouncing off the mat every time. It's the thing that stands out to me the most about that opening match at the Survivor Series in 1995. Candido took the Blonde Bombshell from Marty Jannetty. And I had never seen a powerbomb off the top rope before. I had seen Diesel give the powerbomb, and Sid and Vader, but never from the top rope. That was crazy to me. Tammy ends up at ECW with Chris. And they're both spiraling out of control at this point as far as their drug use. So Paul Heyman does what any scummy, carny promoter would do. He decides to exploit it. And he has Tammy do this tell-all video, and they showed part of it here, talking about her drug use and crying on camera, and you can hear Heyman directing in the background, like after Tammy says, I hoped I just wouldn't wake up the next morning. And you hear Heyman go, oh, tell us more about that. Describe the feeling for us. But when Chris and Tammy were suspended from ECW, and I think it may have been a storyline suspension, but they were off television, Heyman gave them office jobs to keep them on payroll. And Chris also just wanted to help. A lot of the ECW talent, you've heard them tell stories over the years, Taz and Bubba Ray Dudley, Tommy Dreamer, they did other jobs behind the scenes. You know, Taz, I think, was helping with merchandise and t-shirts. So they were all trying to pitch in and do what they could to help ECW. And Chris wanted to do the same thing. So Heyman gave them office jobs. And their job was to front the money on their own credit card to book flights for the wrestlers. And then Heyman would pay them back in cash. And that went on for a while until one day the cash stopped coming. Heyman stopped paying them because the company was in trouble financially. So Heyman just stopped reimbursing them. They ended up in so much debt because of this. They had to sell their house and his credit was destroyed. Candido talked about this years ago. He was left $170,000 in debt on his American Express card and had to sell his house to pay it back because he was being sued by the credit card company. And then, in case that wasn't scummy enough, Heyman wouldn't let Chris and Tammy out of their contracts to go work for WCW so they could actually make money unless they signed papers barring them from suing him for the money that he owed them. So he would let them go. But, you know, the 170 grand or whatever it was, you gotta let that go. So Chris signed the papers because what choice did he have? He had to make money. This episode did not paint Paul Heyman in a good light at all. He screwed over a lot of people, but it kind of reminds me of the Kimona story. Remember Kimona Wanalea? They had a show that had technical problems and I think the ring broke. And Paul Heyman was afraid the fans in the building were going to riot. They were in the ECW arena. So he told Kimona, go do a strip tease for them. And she agreed to do it so long as the footage never aired on television. And then Heyman ended up airing it on one of their VHS tapes. And it ended up in commercials on television for years and years. Until the very end, I think. I remember those commercials. It was the night that Kimona danced atop the ECW arena. And they show footage of her dancing. I think she quit the company over that when she found out that Heyman was selling tapes and, you know, she wasn't seeing any money out of it. But there's plenty of other Paul Heyman stories. I mean, Tommy Dreamer nearly murdering him on live television at WrestleMania 17 and then turning the gun on himself. That is still the craziest story that I ever heard. He had so much at one point animosity towards Paul Heyman because Heyman screwed his parents over. And he was so out of his mind that for days, maybe weeks, he was contemplating showing up at WrestleMania X7 because Paul Heyman was doing commentary. He had just joined the company. He was doing announcing with Jim Ross that night. It's still looked at to this day as maybe the greatest WrestleMania of all time. And imagine if Tommy Dreamer had gone through with this plan. His plan was to get down to that ringside area through the crowd right behind where the announcers were sitting and pop Heyman right in the head from behind. Just whack him from behind. One gunshot. And then he was going to turn the gun on himself. You think the Benoit stuff was bad? Bad black eye for the wrestling business? Imagine if that would have happened. On live television. Anyway, Chris finally kicks his addiction. He turns his life around. He got himself back in shape. He ends up in TNA. And then he suffered a horrific ankle injury that ultimately killed him. It was Six Sides of Steel at Lockdown. It was Candido and Lance Archer against Apollo and Sonny Siaki. Now, there's a cameraman inside the ring with them, inside the cage. And Candido takes a bump off a dropkick. He tries to avoid colliding with the cameraman on the way down. He doesn't want to hurt the cameraman. So he bumps away from him. And in doing so, his foot gets caught underneath his leg. And he snaps his ankle. Technically, it was a dislocated ankle. He broke his fibula and his tibia. It was a very nasty injury, and he realized instantly he could not stand up, so he tagged out. And they take him to the hospital, and he told his brother he was embarrassed to have had to leave the match. That was all he was concerned about. This man could not even stand. His leg was snapped, and all he felt was embarrassment that he didn't finish the match. So he underwent surgery. 2 days after this gruesome injury, he shows up at the tapings, and he does a promo. Then he boards a flight home, gets home, he's talking to his mother on the phone. He tells his mother, I'm not really feeling well. And his mother tells him, you probably shouldn't have flown home, which is what they tell people after they've had surgery. You really should not fly right away because you could develop blood clots. That's what I was worried about after I hurt my knee a few years ago. I just wanted to get home, though. So I flew home anyway, which was probably stupid. But she said that was the last time she spoke to him. And his brother said, look, he sounded fine on the phone the night before when I talked to him. The next morning, he gets a phone call that Chris is in the hospital. And by the time he got there and he saw him, he grabbed his hand. He's trying to get him to open his eyes. And he realizes that the blood isn't pumping. He's already gone. And at that point, you know, in telling the story, Johnny had to take a break. Lance Storm broke down crying. Dr. Tom broke down crying. He could barely speak. It was heartbreaking to watch, but you can tell how much this man meant to these people. The doctors told Tammy that what happened is after the surgery, a blood clot formed in his ankle and it went to his lungs, which caused him to get pneumonia, and then it went to his heart. And at that point, there was nothing that could be done. You know, listening to Chris's mom talk about how she felt she let her son down, that was awful. It's awful that she feels that way. She said that she should have been there for him after the surgery, not let him go through it by himself. You know, maybe if I would have done this, maybe if I would have said that. I mean, that sounds pretty normal, pretty typical, I think, in a situation like this to have that sort of guilt. But, you know, it's not her fault. Back to Cornette, who's talking through tears like I haven't seen since the episode they did on Owen Hart. He's talking about how here's a kid who did not do anything to anyone, who got over his problems, and a broken ankle is what killed him. It's just brutal. He says if Candido was coming up today in the business, he would be a massive star because the style has changed so much. The fans like smaller, faster guys. Terry heard Tammy once say that she has no regrets, and she wondered, how can someone say those words and actually mean them? She says the last time she spoke with Tammy was after she got out of jail. Who knows which time that was? I've lost track of how many times this woman has been behind bars. Then we got audio of Tammy laughing about having had 7 DUIs and a couple of stints in jail. And then the news about her killing someone last year when she got behind the wheel, drunk, with no license. And she got behind the wheel that night and she plowed into another car and killed somebody. She is where she belongs now. Here's hoping they lock her up and they throw away the key so she can't hurt anybody ever again. You know, on the one hand, you have somebody in Chris Candido who fell into bad habits, wanted to change his life around, did so, and never got the second chance that he deserved. He had it unfairly taken away from him. And on the other hand, you have a woman who has no remorse for anything that she has ever done. In fact, she laughs about it. No compassion for others, no empathy, only cares about herself, and now has taken someone else's life. Fuck her. Chris Candido deserved better than Tammy Sitch. He deserved a better ending to his story. But he made more of a positive impact on people in his 33 years on this earth than Tammy has in her 50. So she goes on trial this fall on a charge of DUI manslaughter in Florida. She also has 2 civil cases pending against her in Florida stemming from that same case, and unrelated charges pending against her in the state of New Jersey. She also owes the state of Pennsylvania almost $6,000 in restitution stemming from 4 arrests in that state between 2015 and 2016. The woman is a lost cause. Episode 2 this week covers the Magnum TA story, one of the greatest what-ifs in wrestling history, so that should be good. I'm looking forward to that. All right, let's get to some of your mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Jack from San Diego. Do you think that Cody's current WWE contract will be his last as a full-time wrestler? I ask this because even in AEW, he was teasing retirement. The truth is, once he inevitably finishes the story and becomes WWE champion, what else is there really left for him to do? What are your thoughts? A few years ago, Cody said he only wanted to wrestle until he turned 40. And then he would love to run for a Senate seat in Georgia. If he's serious about getting into politics, I could see him stepping away from wrestling for a little bit to do what Kane did. But is that going to happen in the next few years? Absolutely not. Is this going to be the last full-time contract he signs? Absolutely not. Not a chance. He's in the position now he always wanted to be in. You think he's going to willingly give that up? I mean, what's left for him to do? Make a fuck ton of money, that's what. Dude's the top merch seller in the company right now. He's not going anywhere. I remember Booker T once saying he planned to retire at 40. And then he turned 40. And he said he thought, well, why would I retire? I feel pretty good. And then he went like another 5 years. And even now, he's not retired. He still gets into the ring from time to time. Wrestlers say a lot of things. When a wrestler sets a date or an age by which they want to retire, typically that does not happen. Jared from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Can Tony Khan stop Darby Allin from climbing Mount Everest next year if he wants to? Why would he allow one of his top talents to do something so dangerous that would take him away from AEW for a while? Tony Khan can't do much. If Darby wants to climb a mountain, he's going to climb a mountain. And there isn't much that his boss can do other than maybe threaten him legally. But I mean, what's he going to threaten him with? I don't think Darby would care. He seems hell-bent on doing this. He even said when he reaches the top of the summit, his goal is to plant an AEW flag on the mountain. He's doing this to try to get more attention on the company. As much as it's, you know, as much as anything else. He's doing it for himself also. But he really wants to do it to try to get more attention for AEW. So, I mean, how can Tony Khan get mad at him? I'm sure he's concerned. But that would be the most loyal thing anybody's ever done for this company. Literally putting their life at risk to plant a flag with their logo on it on top of the biggest mountain in the world. I mean, and Darby is very serious about this. You know, he has done interviews. He's talked about having a team from Discovery already reach out to him to document the whole thing. So he's thought this out. I think he's nuts, but this is what he does. You know, he's a daredevil. He's talking about never having confidence in some of these interviews when he was younger. So he does these stunts to give him more confidence as an adult. That's why he does all the daredevil stuff that he does. So for him, this is a big deal. You know, but it's extremely dangerous. People die on that mountain all the time. Already this year, people have died making the climb. And the morbid part about all this is that most of the bodies from over the years, they're still up there. I think there's something like 200 plus bodies that are still up on that mountain. And there have been over 300 people I know that have died. But there are bodies everywhere. I mean, some of them are just laying out in the open so that the other climbers, when they get up there, they see them. They're just laying in the snow, probably forever, because it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous and very expensive to try to move them. And some people sign waivers beforehand to leave them up there. If they don't make it, just leave my body where it is. It's like a graveyard up there. Jalen from Atlanta, Georgia. As much as I hate comparing new talent to old ones, Seth Rollins' Shawn Michaels spot with Rhea Ripley on Raw got me thinking, would you call Seth Rollins a modern-day Shawn Michaels? I would prefer to think of Seth as his own man, but his charisma has gone through the roof in recent times, and he's arguably one of the best wrestlers in the world today. Yeah, I don't like doing the comparisons too much either. I don't really see him as this generation Shawn Michaels. You know, and by the way, the spot that he's talking about, Shawn did a spot with Melina at Survivor Series many years ago. Might have been 06, somewhere around there, where he did like a baseball slide to the floor. Melina had her back turned. He put his arm around her. She didn't realize it right away. She thought it was her man. And then he looked at her, she looked at him, and she got all spooked, and it was a comedy spot. So Seth did a similar spot with Rhea Ripley on Raw Monday night. So that's what he's referring to. I personally, I don't look at it that way. I look at Seth as his own beast. The only comparison I would make, as far as in-ring workers, Shawn was pretty consistently the best worker in the company when he was on top. And I think people look at Seth, and the company probably looks at Seth in the same way. So you could say that what Shawn Michaels was to WWE when he was on top there for all those years, that's sort of the position that Seth Rollins is in now. Seth is the one that everybody wants to work with. Even people outside the company want to work with him. That interview that Will Ospreay did with Chris Van Vliet, he said if he had one real Forbidden Door match that he could do, who would it be against? And he didn't hesitate. He said Seth Rollins. So that's the comparison I would make. But I don't look at him, oh, he's the modern day, you know, Shawn Michaels. Shawn was his own guy. And I look at Seth also just as his own person. Jason from County, is it Monaghan? I hope I'm pronouncing that right. County Monaghan, Ireland. I was thinking about when the time comes when WWE inducts John Cena into the Hall of Fame, whenever that may be. A lot of people would say Edge, Randy Orton, or even Vince McMahon himself would induct Cena. But I really see Cena going a different route. I can see Cena being inducted by his father, or even young adults who Cena had met when they were kids for Make-A-Wish, or the people who are in charge of the Make-A-Wish Foundation to induct him for all that he has done throughout the years. What say you? I think that you are onto something there. I could absolutely see that. I could see Cena being inducted maybe even by multiple people connected to Make-A-Wish, including people that maybe, you know, he granted their wish. And, you know, they lived and they're still around and, you know, they're on that stage paying tribute to John Cena. I could absolutely see him, you know, wanting to do something like that. That's actually a very cool idea. Sean from Byron, Illinois. I enjoyed your take on the Mount Rushmore of Intercontinental Champions. A few weeks ago, WWE celebrated 60 years of the WWE Championship. So my question is, who is on that Mount Rushmore for you of the greatest WWE champions? Well, if you could do it based upon who were the most important figures of their eras, it would have to be Bruno Sammartino, Hulk Hogan, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and John Cena. But this is my Mount Rushmore of WWE champions, and Bruno was before my time. My Mount Rushmore of WWE champions and the ones I most associate with that title would be Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and The Rock. Hogan, Bret, Austin, Rock. That's my Mount Rushmore of WWE champions. He says also, what would you put on your Mount Rushmore of greatest WWE championship matches? That was the other part of his question. Well, that depends. Are we including the 92 Royal Rumble, which was technically a WWE championship match? Let's leave that one out. We'll put that one on the side. If we leave that one out, my Mount Rushmore of WWE title matches would be Hogan Warrior WrestleMania 6. Cannot put into words how big of a deal that was. As a young wrestling fan at the time, that was a big deal. To see those two guys one-on-one, champion against champion, title for title. Hogan Warrior, Bret Owen in a cage at SummerSlam in 94. Greatest cage match I've ever seen. I'm torn on number three. If we're going in like sequential order here, I'm torn on number three because I could go either way with this. It's either Rock against Triple H at Backlash 2000 or the Steve Austin Dude Love match from Over the Edge in 98. Which turned 25 years old this week, by the way. I'm torn on which one I would go with. And then John Cena against CM Punk in Money in the Bank in 2011. So that would be my Mount Rushmore of matches. There you go. And Jerome from Sin City, USA. I was listening to you talk about the invasion angle, and it made me think, why did WWE rush to start it? By the time Survivor Series came around, Ric Flair was on his way in, and early next year, the NWO came in. Do you know why they rushed to start this invasion? They almost had no choice because they did acquire some talent contracts. Actually, quite a few talent contracts. You can't keep those people all on ice for 6 months, or 9 months, or for a year. So they felt like if we're going to bring these WCW people in, it would be kind of weird. I'm just trying to get in their heads on this. Maybe they looked at it and thought, well, it's going to be weird if we're bringing in new talent to the company throughout the rest of 2001. clearly from WCW, and then we're going to do this sudden invasion angle. Now, I disagree. I agree with you. There was no need to rush it. You could have brought in people, Billy Kidman and fucking Rey Mysterio or whoever, right? Whoever you want to talk about, bring them in, let them debut, right? Not all at once, but you gradually bring in new talent. And then when you're ready and you have some big names, you're not going to get them all at once, but you've got Flair and Hogan and Hall and Nash or, you know, whoever. Sting, they didn't get Sting. And they got Goldberg even later, right? But you get a certain number of top names. And now you do this invasion angle. And it really is built on the core big names. But you could have some of these smaller mid-card names be part of it too. It's almost like, I hate to even say this, it's almost like these like terror cells that they've implanted in this company. They debuted, they're on the roster, they're mixed in with all the other talent, but we come to find out later on, this was all part of a longer master plan. They were all there waiting to get the cue from headquarters, right? From Eric Bischoff or whoever the mastermind was. And then one day they lower the boom on the WWE roster. I'm just saying there were ways to make it work. But I can understand why they may have felt the need to like, all right, we got to go with this right away. We got DDP, we got Booker T, we got all these people. We got to do something here. So let's do an invasion. And it's too bad because the invasion could have worked if they had the names to make it work. And it was going to be very difficult to make it work and make it feel like a big deal without people like Hogan and the Outsiders and Bischoff or Goldberg or Steiner or Sting or Flair, any of those people. Even just take half of them. So it didn't work. It was a hollow invasion. By the end of the year, it was over. Because by that point, you know, nobody really cared. The bloom was off the rose. It didn't feel like a big deal. That should have been the biggest thing of all time in wrestling. Fans used to fantasy book these supercards, WWF against WCW, and they blew the whole damn thing. And Hans in Sitka, Alaska, do you think when WWE castoffs go to win major titles in other companies, it makes those promotions look less than? Steve Macklin is the current Impact champion as an example. In the past, guys like EC3, Ken Anderson, Rich Swann, right now Tyrus in the NWA, Matt Cardona, and others who struggled to get on TV. Doesn't that look bad? Tyrus is the NWA champion looks bad, yes. That we can agree on, because Tyrus sucks. Tyrus with the NWA World Heavyweight title is a fucking embarrassment. And I don't care what he talks about in interviews or on other television shows. Just watch a Tyrus match, and that's all you need to know. On the other stuff, though, I disagree. I don't look at it that way. I don't look at it as less than. Steve Macklin was nobody in WWE, right? They never pushed him as being anybody that people should care about. So in NXT and in WWE, and I think he got swept up in that whole situation with the Forgotten Sons and what happened with the head guy. I already forgot what his name is, but yeah, he got a raw deal. I'm not saying Steve Macklin would have been a WWE champion, but did he really get a fair shot? No, he didn't. And now he's doing big things at Impact, and good for him. I haven't seen too much of his run. I did see the angle they did a few weeks ago where he and Bully Ray put Scott D'Amore through a flaming table, and fucking Steve Macklin was just covered in blood. I did see that. But Macklin seems to be doing well for himself. Matt Cardona completely reinvented himself on the independent scene. He made himself a star. When he goes and is on a GCW show, or he's on some other independent show, he's the House of Glory World Heavyweight Champion. He's our world champion right now, right? He had a big match with Jacob Fatu a few weeks ago and beat him for the belt. There's a noticeable uptick in business when Matt Cardona is on the show. This is a totally different person than the one you saw on WWE television. The fact that he struggled to get television time is not his fault. That's on the company. The company didn't see enough in him to do more with him. Maybe he would not have been WWE champion. But could they have done more with Zack Ryder? Of course they could have. There's a lot of talent that you could say that about. Sometimes WWE is right. A person only has a ceiling that's so high. They aren't at that level. But there are plenty of other people who get a raw deal and they have to leave. They have to go somewhere else to show them, look at what I can do. And then some of them end up back in WWE and they're a bigger star because of it. Look at Drew McIntyre. So no, I don't look at it as a bad look. I look at them going out there and showing what they can do. And in a lot of cases, these guys are really good. And they can draw people in. Like Cardona's been doing. So no, I don't look at that as a bad thing at all. Anyway, good stuff. Keep emailing me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. I want to hear from you guys. Follow me on Twitter, @solemnmonster. Of course, we have another week full of streaming coming up. We've got Raw Monday night, Dynamite this week, SmackDown coming up. A few weeks from now, we'll have the premiere of AEW Collision. Forbidden Door just got a hell of a lot more interesting with the big match announcements this morning. So a lot of big stuff coming up. And of course, next Sunday, I'll be back with you for episode 812. Right here on all the usual platforms, all the usual apps, wherever you find your Sound Off podcast, I'll be back with you next weekend. So until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you for all the love and support this week, and I will see you back here for episode 812 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemnmonster Sounds Off.
Why is Solemnmonster a punk hater? Why does he hate punk so much? What did he ever do to him?
Clearly, you have not been paying attention to what I have been saying. All I said, Tony Khan knows what he's getting himself into. Where in that statement that I hate on punk? Where are the brain worms coming from? How do they get inside the skull? I don't get it. But all you people who want to go on and on and on and on and on about the hate on punk, go ahead. He doesn't even know you exist. He's not going to give you a free autograph. He's not going to give you a free hand job. So calm down.
The Solemnmonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solemnmonster on Twitter @Solemnmonster.
Solemnmonster.
Solemnmonster. Solemnmonster Sounds Off.